You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. This one is Remember This Crap. So with me, as always, to remember crap is Mike Donahue. You can find him at Twitter at Hugh Cub. Mike, how are you doing?
Doing good, Andy. Thanks.
Good. So the Bears are making their 2020 Monday Night Football debut, and they're playing our old friends, the Los Angeles Rams.
The Rams on Monday night. Here with all my Rams on Monday night.
It was just a year ago, right, where they played on Sunday night?
I can't keep track because they definitely played them on Sunday night 2 years ago because it was flexed to Sunday night in Soldier Field.
Yes, last year it was at wherever they were playing. I guess it's Coliseum. And that was the game where Nagy benched Mitch and then pretended he didn't.
Yeah, I somehow managed to scrub that from my memory, but it was brought up recently.
I brought it up yesterday.
But it was brought up when he benched Mitch this year.
Yeah,
because I had forgotten that he did bench him.
He didn't.
Well, it worked. It worked. His insistence. But at the end of that game, it was a frustrating game. He got benched, and then he started. And I had forgotten it that actually happened until it was brought up. Benched and then started the next week. I'm sure that happens, but it was the Rams game.
So the Rams are an interesting team. They I think if you ask most football fans where they started, they couldn't tell you.
It's an interesting history.
They started in 1937 in Cleveland. Cleveland had two football teams.
Of all places. I don't know if would they have had two in 1937?
Actually, I don't know. Maybe were they the originals and then the Browns came later?
So here's the quick history lesson for all you boys and girls out there. I didn't know that 37 was their first season, but they do go back further than people might realize. And unlike the other team from California, the San Francisco 49ers, they were not a team from another conference. In that case, the All-American Football Conference, which is also where the Colts sort of and the Browns had come from. The Rams were sort of not a charter franchise, but if you go back to 37, that's pretty much the beginning. They won a championship in Cleveland in 45. They beat the Washington football team, and then immediately, as soon as they won that championship, they could not wait to move to Los Angeles. So, not that you need to add to the list of indignities that the city of Cleveland has suffered through the years, but they field a football team that immediately leaves for greener pastures. The Browns then, as part of this newfound rival AAFC, I think in 46 or 47, of course, immediately won every season before they were forced to merge with the NFL in 1950. And from that point, the Browns went to six straight title games, oftentimes playing the Rams. And that was sort of the Rams' first glory season, but it was in LA. So yeah, they started in Cleveland. They won a championship in Cleveland. They had Bob Waterfield, with the Q factor of their star quarterback. Like I said, they couldn't wait to just get the hell to the West Coast. There was more opportunity. That's where everything was going, or it would. They're kind of pioneers doing it in 1946.
Yeah, they would have been the first major sports team in California. Yeah, because the Dodgers didn't come until
57. Yeah, a good decade. So yeah, baseball was still east of the Mississippi till then.
So Cleveland was a two football team town for exactly 1 year.
is in the NFL. Right. Yeah. 1 year, 45, I'm guessing. Right. So maybe, you know, if nothing else, they were bracing for the for their departure. And it also shows that, boy, Cleveland was really actually, hard as it may seem to believe, the epicenter of pro football then for about an 11-year period.
Yeah, well, they had the, Ohio. They had the Canton Bulldogs. I don't know how. I can't. Right. I can't speak to that. I can't go back that far. And Ohio, actually, I misspoke. They were never a two. They were ships passing in the night. The Rams left. The Rams last season was 45.
Yep. And then so the AAFC began in 46 or 47, right?
46. And you were right. The Browns won all four championships.
So actually the only period that there hasn't been continuous NFL or pro football and professional level football at the highest level, because AAFC was legitimate as proved by Cleveland, winning championships early after they joined. But the only period between 1937 and today in which there was no high-level professional football in Cleveland would have been between 1996 and 98, I guess.
Yes. So it's all, Art Rooney can be thanked for that. Not Art Rooney. Art Modell.
Art Modell.
You're the one that's been drinking, and I'm the one that's getting everything wrong.
Hey, they start euchre at 7. I'm just trying to keep it balanced.
The Rams' second coach was a guy named Hugo Bezdek.
Love it.
Hugo went 1-13 and then was asked not to coach anymore.
So, okay.
So I think my favorite Rams coach.
Is he the first coach you remember? Because I was actually coming in ready to ask you that.
Okay. The first coach I remember is Chuck Knox. But I don't know that I really remember. I probably remember him from Seattle. And then
you should.
So I would guess it's John Robinson. And that
It's the guy between Knox and Robinson. Ray Malavasi.
Ray Malavasi. Yeah. Well, I don't remember Ray Malavasi. That's the problem.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I
was
do.
Was there Abe Gibron?
He's the one that took him to the Super Bowl in 79.
He's 40-33.
I will tell you, and I've referenced 1979 like it's the Smashing Pumpkins song, but it is the first year that I was consciously aware of the Cubs and the Bears, and it would have been the first year that my dad took me to a regular season Bears game. It was also the first year he took me to a preseason game when I saw the Jets, but I got to go to one. He only had three tickets, and you only have so many seats. And it wasn't itching to go, but I was excited to go. And they played the Rams, and they beat them. It was kind of I can't remember any details from the game because I was only 7. I just remember that I think it was 27-21. And I remember, looking to my right, the big I don't even think they had installed the new crappy scoreboard at Old Soldier Field at that point, but where the clock was ticking down and the fans in my area were all counting down from 10. Very exciting. Both teams went to the playoffs. Both teams – I believe, they only had one wild card, or the Bears played the Eagles, got knocked out, but eventually the Rams finally broke through and went to the Super Bowl with Ray Malavasi and then lost to Terry Bradshaw and the Steelers. It was Pittsburgh's fourth Super Bowl. But yeah, my first regular season game was seeing that team, and I'm pretty sure Ferragamo was under center because he was in the Super Bowl, but really Pat Hayden, I believe, was supposed to be their quarterback, but he got hurt.
I think that's right. So,
yeah.
Ray Malavasi, if they were going to cast, it wouldn't really be Ned Beatty. It would Charles Durning with a fright wig would be Ray Malavasi.
But if you, I just have to say, if you're going to go with Charles Durning, why not just go with Brian Dennehy?
Dennehy, I think, was a little more athletic looking than Ray. Maybe not.
Yeah, he wasn't. He wasn't athletic looking. And that's why I remember.
That's quality. Way to go, Ray.
That's almost a Yogi Berra-ism. Actually, know who he looked like? Not Brian Dennehy or Charles Durning, now that I think about it. And this is probably totally off because I'm not looking at a picture of him right now. This is all in my mind's eye. I'm picturing Vic Tabak.
Oh, yeah. I can see that.
Uh-oh. Yeah. Also known as Mel from Mel's Diner and Alice.
From Alice. So
I think that's what I kind of thought at the time when I first looked at the game program.
Vic Tabak
is what's Mel doing?
Ray Malavasi. Matt, they just call him Mal. It was Mal's Diner. Wasn't Mel's, it was Mal's. I think we're on to something here.
I think so. We're through the looking glass, people.
So I was going to say my favorite Ram coach, maybe it's because when he coached at USC, Notre Dame beat them repeatedly, was John Robinson. I was like, John. Mm-hmm. And did you know, I guess, that for the last, I want to say at least decade, that John Madden was still on the air, John Robinson was his spotter.
John Robinson was a spotter whenever, after he had retired?
Yes, that was his, like, post-football job. He rode around on the Madden Cruiser with John to every game, and he hung out in the booth, and he just told him who made the tackle and who did whatever else. I mean, talk about job. Yeah.
He just, right, he gets to be pulled along in this humongous chariot across the country.
Yeah, sees all the best football games.
Putting away bottles of scotch on the way. I'm sure he's like having a hell of a time on the road with, like, you know, and Madden, he's always struck me as quite the rock on tour. And then, so now it's like game day. All right, now you got to earn your money. Yep. And so he's a spotter, which a spotter is somebody that gives a heads up to the announcers real quick, like who made the play, right?
Yeah, and both announcers have a spotter. So the guy who's spotting for the play-by-play guy has the much tougher job. He is the one who has to quickly do the math as to that was a 52-yard pass, that was a 48-yard punt, that was the tackle was and by number 8. Where the color the guy won, for the depending on what the guy wants, can basically either remind John to talk about something that he knew he wanted to talk about, or I would guess because Robinson was a coach too, he would like notice stuff and be like, hey, John, look at this. And then if it happened again, then they could talk about it. But talk about like the coolest job you could have because they were best friends. So he's just hanging out with his best friend, going to, and for Robinson, he got paid, I'm sure, by...
That's brilliant. I love that. I never heard that before.
That's what he did. I don't know exactly how many years. I could have looked that up. But that's what he did. And it was, I'm sure he talked about it occasionally. But I didn't really know about it until... or was reminded about it. Richard Deitch for The Athletic has written a couple of stories in the last couple of years about, like, there was one he sat in the booth with Romo and Nance and gave kind of the behind the scenes thing about how they work a broadcast.
Deitch did.
Yes. And he worked in the story about, he basically described what the spotters do and mentioned that John Robinson had been Madden's spotter at the end of his career. And I remembered that I knew that somehow.
Okay.
But yeah, it's
from
just,
an earlier anecdote or whatever that you'd come across.
I think for sure at least once a year they would just show him. Maybe the last game.
I don't
game.
Recall.
Hey,
that.
I want to thank my buddy John Robinson.
And you're saying the last 10 years of Madden's career as a broadcaster?
Yeah.
Or okay, cuz like
and I don't know if it's exactly 10, but it was a few years after Robinson stopped coaching.
Yeah, and that would have been like in the late to early 90s. I think they made a championship game and got blown out by San Fran 89, and then within a couple of years he was done. But he still went back to Southern Cal. Because was he not the Southern Cal coach both before and after being the Rams coach? I believe he was. I think he may have succeeded the aforementioned John McKay at Southern Cal.
I didn't know this.
Went to the Rams.
I didn't know he did all this too. John Edward Robinson, born in 1943. Was a convicted serial killer, con man, embezzled. Oh, that's not the right John Robinson.
Amazing.
Wow. And he got away. How did he cram all of that into a career?
Right.
And he coached Dan. What an amazing life. Well, here he is.
OJ went to Southern Cal, too.
Well, that's true. Maybe that's where he learned it.
Yeah. Well, but he played for McKay, I want to say. So it doesn't add up, unfortunately.
Oh, Robinson was a running back coach for Madden for a year with the Raiders. Then he became the USC head coach in 1976. Hopped to the Rams in 83, went back to USC and coached the Rams from 83 to 91, went back to USC at 93 to 97.
Okay.
Then coached at UNLV until 2004.
Wow, 7 more years of earning that paycheck.
Yes.
UNLV. So, interesting that he left the Rams to go back to Southern Cal when I want to say the guy that replaced him was Chuck Knox, who himself was returning to the Rams for his second go around. effect that is absolutely meaningless, but nevertheless failed to escape my attention. Chuck Knox, who you thought you may have remembered as the Rams coach, but would have from the second time around. And they were terrible when Ground Chuck was the Rams coach the second time. But, of course, we both first remember Chuck as being the Seahawks coach, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, Robinson and Madden knew each other. He didn't just randomly coach for him with the Raiders. He went to high school with John Madden at Our Lady of Perpetual Help in Daly City, California.
You're kidding. I literally went to a funeral a week ago. There's a parish in Glenview, Illinois, home of Chuck Ittles. Our Lady of Perpetual Help. The shorthand is, it looks like Olaf. So apropos of nothing, but interesting. So Madden and Robinson go all the way back to the frickin' late 50s.
They graduated in 1950.
Early 50s. Yeah. So they're born in 32. I thought you said Robinson was born in 42.
No, that was the serial killer.
Oh, right.
John Alexander Robinson was born in 1935. And he's still around.
How could his wiki rank go higher than... I never even heard of that serial killer.
Wait a minute.
How is the Rams USC coach?
This can't be right. Okay, so not to besmirch... we think John Robinson graduated from high school in 1950?
He could have. I mean...
Oh, no, I read it wrong. Wiki's right. They didn't go to... I don't know if they went to high school together. They went to grade school together. That's even farther back. Wow. Because he went to Junipero Serra High School in 1950, and graduated in 50.
So Our Lady of Perpetual Help Grammar School must have been there.
Wow. So they're...
In the frickin' 30s.
Yeah, they were kids. They knew each other when they were like 12 years old.
Thick as thieves. Yeah, it is cool. Wow, that's like the old Pete, or was it Don Zimmer and Jim Fry? Supposedly were childhood friends.
It's Tom Izzo and John Steve Mariucci from Iron City, Michigan.
But I would think that the Madden Robinson takes the cake.
Well, yeah, it's a Pro Football Hall of Fame coach and a College Football Hall of Fame coach.
And a pretty successful NFL coach. The Rams in the 80s, we've talked about it. The more since you first brought it up, Andy, the more it sort of cemented in my brain just how special the NFC was in the 1980s. And the Rams were like a distant fourth. They were never really bad. And they did make a title game, as we all, of course, remember in Chicago.
Yeah,
they made a couple.
Remember that game.
They made the January of 86 at Soldier Field, Soldier's Field, my friend. But also played the title game in 89. Like I said, I just mentioned that earlier, but they got blown out. Dallas and the Rams were sort of like the next tier behind the dominance that was the Giants and 49ers and Bears and Redskins.
Yeah, Robinson, they made the playoffs in six of his first 7 years. Lost two NFC title games, one to the Bears, one to the Niners. And then kind of bottomed out at the end.
Yeah.
They went 8-24 his last 2 years he got canned.
Yeah, that really was the end of a pretty long run because we talked about it before the show, I think. The Rams in the 70s were sort of an unheralded but consistently good team that I didn't even know about till more recently because growing up, as you and I did in the late 70s and early 80s, we knew about the Cowboys, even if we weren't in the Vikings, even if we weren't like watching the games in 77, 78, we had older brothers. It was kind of background noise. We certainly knew who the Cowboys were, the Vikings we were familiar with. And it was years later that I realized that the Rams made three consecutive title games in the 70s. They lost the Vikings in 74 and 75, or 74 and 76. They lost the Cowboys in 75. Pretty much made the playoffs every year for a while there until they finally broke through under the aforementioned Ray Malavasi in 79 and gave the Steelers a good fight in the Super Bowl. And it was only 6 years after that Robinson took them to the championship game. So by the end of Robinson's tenure, that was actually, you could argue, almost a two-decade run of above-average performance. So
the Robinson Rams would have suffered from the same. I mean, think about that. So he coached a really good football team, but they finished second in the NFC West every year because The fucking Niners. 49ers are in there. It's the same thing we talked about, how many championships the Niners, Giants, Bears, and Redskins cost each other by all being awesome at the same time. Here are the poor Rams, who have a really good football team and can't even win their division, which means they always have to play in the freaking wild card game.
Right.
So,
don't
feel that.
Yeah. No, but it just further bolsters that notion that that conference in that decade has to rank as just one of the most exquisite periods of football from one side.
So those, I guess we were talking a little bit before we came on about the those 70s Rams teams. They wouldn't have been. That wouldn't have been the fearsome foursome. It would have been after that. That would have been the – oh, it's even better. That would have been the Jack Youngblood, Fred Dreyer, Hunter.
That's right.
Rams. The because the original fearsome foursome for the Rams, according to Wikipedia also, technically started in 1963 when they added Rosie Greer to
– Merlin Olsen.
Merlin Olsen, Deacon Jones, and Lamar Lundy.
Yep. Okay.
Deacon Jones, of course, famous for, he claims he invented the term sack because he, and I use this once in a while, he said he would tell the other guys it's time to put the quarterback in a sack, which makes very little sense. Unless you're gonna, I guess he's going to kidnap him.
You want to tell him?
Right. No, nobody's going to tell Deacon. Deacon, he went back, they didn't keep track of sacks. He went back and counted one year. Said he had 36 sacks.
he just shows up in the Rams like archive video room and like, I'm sorry, sir, I can't show you. And you know, a few minutes later, Fred's watching all the game footage. You know, I didn't intend to do this. I have no Deacon Jones seems like a character. I have no animosity towards Merlin Olsen, who in some ways was the voice of our childhood, being the number one color commentary alongside Dick Enberg.
And he got a Little House on the Prairie spinoff.
He was Father Murphy. Lamar Lundy, you know, but we grew up hearing about the fearsome foursome, and yet they played from like 63 to 73. Like, why wasn't that team any good? Like, what made, if they were that fucking great? And yeah, I know you can say they have a terrible offense. Is this just some sort of a West Coast hype machine, Andy? I ask you.
Well, and they were apparently the fourth team to be dubbed having a fearsome foursome, and Rosie Greer played on two of them. So, according to this, in 1957, the first fearsome foursome were the Giants. It was Andy Robustelli, Jim Cat Cavage, Rosie Greer, and Dick Modzelewski. Now, the name's much better. Robustelli, Cat Cavage, Rosie Greer, Modzelewski.
Right.
Then they claimed that then the AFL version of that, supposedly, was the Chargers had Ron Neary, Bill Hudson, Ernie Ladd, and Earl Faison.
Would that have been the original Los Angeles Chargers then, probably? Was that in their first year that they would be bold enough to... I'm driving it in a thought here, but go on. Who is
they were listed here as? They don't have the year, but they're listed here as San Diego, and it said the Chargers foursome helped them reach the first two American Football League championship games.
So first one had to be L.A.
Five altogether, and they won the AFL title in '63, beating the Boston Patriots 51-10. Actually, 5 points worse than what the Bears did to the New England Patriots.
Wow, who knew that the Patriots' defeat in January of 86 was not their worst championship game defeat?
So then the third iteration of the fearsome foursome was supposedly the Lions, and that was 1962, Roger Brown, Alex Karras, Darius McCord, and Sam Williams.
Okay, so that blows my theory, because I started to think the fearsome foursome is just some concept that started on Madison Avenue in New York, and they tried to apply it to the Giants, and then it flew across country to the new media empire.
Well, it did, but I guess it bounced around. So, it all happened fast, apparently. So the Giants were 57. They get dubbed the fearsome foursome. The Chargers, it says here, 61, their first year in San Diego. They had a fearsome foursome. The next year, the Lions claim to have a fearsome foursome, and then the year after that, Rosie goes to the Rams, and they supposedly have one. So that nickname sucks.
Right, it does. It does suck, and that was even without knowing that there were four of them, because I was considering the Rams owning it dubious. Again, no, not to besmirch those players, but you don't hear of the Rams and, you know, even contending, and I mean, they were in title games or Super Bowls by the end of the decade. They were a much better team 10 years after those guys left. So
yeah,
I think we did it. We just killed the myth of the fearsome foursome, I hope, once and for all. It was not my agenda coming in.
Proven that it's bullshit.
It is. And I'm not afraid to go to just have that take right now. Even if all four of those guys are Hall of Famers, they might be. I mean, and it wasn't like, again, John Robinson and Eric Dickerson and Jim Everett, or that can't be possible because they were traded for each other. But, you know, those teams running into great teams. Who would have were the Rams? I guess they could have been running into the Packers. You know, the Cowboys were good, but still, if they're that great, they would have overcome it. The Packers are getting pretty old by 67 anyway, so at least they would have pushed Dallas aside to challenge them for supremacy. So there, I found a reason to hate on the Rams after complimenting them for their John Robinson years.
So I think we all know who the greatest quarterback in Rams history was. Dieter Brock.
Dieter Brock came down from the CFL.
And so that, that era brings to mind my one Rams bear story. And this is from Mike Singletary's autobiography, so it has to be true because he's not going to lie about this.
Is his autobiography called "Cannot Win with Them"? Sorry.
In his autobiography, it's a picture of him standing in the middle of the locker room with his pants around his ankles, yelling at his team, kicking, benching, making Vernon Davis go home during a game. That's the cover.
And then just like a room full of confused faces as part of the panoramic view.
So the Bears, as we know, finally got good in 1984. In fact, one of the lost great Bear games of all time is the complete thumping they put on the Redskins in the playoffs that year, where Todd Bell killed Joe Washington.
Goddamn right.
Week 11 of the 84 season, the 7-3 Bears flew out to L.A. to take on the 6-4 Rams.
In 84?
In 84. Things did not go. Yes, I looked it up.
Okay.
Things did not go so well for our Bears. The Rams won 29-13. The Bears had a 10-0 lead, and then that evaporated. Bob Thomas, rare combination here, made a 52-yard field goal, missed an extra point. Eric Dickerson had himself a game in that one. 28 carries for 149 yards and 2 touchdowns.
Oof.
Singletary claims on the second touchdown carry, he's running back towards the bench and he crosses Singletary, and Dickerson yells at Singletary, "I got gas all day," which, man, it could be that he had to toot, but basically he was telling him, you know, "I'm not slowing down. I got gas all day." So now we fast forward to the NFC title game in January of 1986. And maybe that game is
14 months or so later.
That game is most the image everyone has of that game is Wilbur Marshall in the snow picking up the fumble and running for the touchdown. That's other thing everybody remembers was a 3rd-and-1 where Dickerson gets the ball and Singletary happily greets him in the hole and completely stands him up. This huge running back that rarely went backwards. Singletary he didn't gain a centimeter from the time he hit Singletary. Singletary picks him up, plants him, and yells at him, "You're out of gas." And Dickerson, of course, had no fucking clue why Singletary said that to him. He didn't remember what he said 14 months ago, but Singletary had been thinking about it pretty much daily for 14 months. And I just love that story because I know
it's great.
True. I absolutely know it's true.
In 84, 85, 86, that was peak Singletary. You know, he was a rookie in 81, and he was at his most maniacal, just at his.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Peak. I think sometimes Singletary, you know, he was smaller. Sometimes he, you know, he's a Hall of Famer, but like the arc of his career may not have been as great as I mean, I'm having a hard time articulating it, but in those like 3 or 4 years in the middle, he was absolutely as dominant as it was suggested.
I mean, he was a great football player. He probably got more attention than he deserved because he was the Bears' middle linebacker.
Correct.
But he also suffered then by comparison to Bill George, Dick Butkus.
Yep.
You know, he wasn't – those are two of the greatest middle linebackers of NFL history, and he wasn't as good as them. But that didn't mean he wasn't really good.
Yeah.
And then I think consensus is Urlacher surpassed him, so he's
– Yeah.
And I don't know. I guess when we have Vaj McCaskey on later, we can ask her of where Bulldog Turner ranks on that.
Sure. Right. Yeah. I'm sure Vaj has an opinion or two. And Andy, I apologize for even questioning. I found a black hole in my memory because I cannot recall that. I'm looking at it now. And yeah, 29-13. I'm looking at all these other games and I can tell you like two or three factoids that happened. I see the game at St. Louis in 84 where Neil Lomax threw a 60-yard bomb to Roy Green. I see the Raiders game was the week before the epic Bears Raiders game when the Bears defense like totally arrived. I cannot for the life of me recall that Bears Rams game in 84. So full confession, just throwing it out there. But thanks for sharing that story.
Well, it's a weird game because
that was.
So listen to Jeff Kemp. Jeff Kemp was our quarterback, for God's sakes. Listen to his stat line.
In 84?
Yeah. 7 of 15 for 175 yards and a touchdown.
That
he
was
only completed
year...
7 passes, but he threw for 175 yards. I mean, 63 of them went to Henry Ellard in one play.
So they still had Ellard in 84 because pretty sure he was on their Super Bowl team in 79. The other thing was that was the year Dickerson broke O.J. Simpson's single-season rushing record. I'm pretty sure. Was it not 84? I think it was Dickerson's second season in the league.
Yep.
And, yeah.
2,105 yards. Yeah, Eric Dickerson he was pretty good his first 2 years.
He was incredible.
His first year, he ran for 1,808 yards and 18 touchdowns. Yeah. His second year, he ran for 2,105 yards and 14 touchdowns. And then he really cooled off in 85. He only ran for 1,200 yards. But then he came back in 86, and he ran for 1,800 yards again.
Yeah. I had this weird thing growing up, and there was no reason to be insecure. Walter Payton was the greatest running back, arguably of all time, and certainly in our era. But like, I always had a little bit of resentment, right, and defensiveness about other running backs. Like first and foremost was Tony Dorsett, who was a great running back, but he was on a great team. So really, Dorsett just seems sort of effete by comparison. There's something just trying to find a way to dismiss him, right? Because whatever. But Billy Sims came into the league 1980 in the Bears division, and he was really good for a couple of years. He was a Heisman winner at Oklahoma, and that was we talked about that. One of the brief periods of time where the Lions actually weren't bad, and Sims was a big reason why. But it really kind of worked up a hatred towards him because, you know, he can't be as good as Walter. And so certainly when Dickerson burst onto the scene and, you know, Peyton had challenged that record in 77. He had like 1,800 yards himself. He came within a couple hundred yards of breaking OJ's record and then, you know, proceeded to have a couple just above average seasons. But Dickerson's one of those guys that I really took me a while to respect him because I was so blinded by the competition and the jealousy and the envy because we had a, you know, once in a lifetime generation, but goddamn, that guy was something else there for a few years. Got to hand it to him.
Yeah. He was, his first 7 years in the league, he ran for 11,000 yards. He averaged 1,600 yards a season. For the first 7 years, and then what do we do after that? Well, I mean, he got his ass kicked every day for 7 years. And I mean, that was one of the great things about Walter was how well he conditioned. Dickerson was basically, I didn't remember how good he was his first full year with the Colts. He ran for almost 1,700 yards.
Yeah, I didn't either.
But by his age 30 year, he was done. He never ran for more than 700. He ran for 729 yards one season his last 4 years. But yeah, his first seven, he was as good as any running back who'd ever
played. 7 year period. Yep. Is John Robinson dead or alive?
He's alive.
Okay.
Him and Madden are probably still tooling around the West in a motor coach.
I don't know how much longer Madden's got, but, you know, God bless him nonetheless. So they play on Monday night this week, huh?
Yeah, it's Monday Night Football. Our first experience with the revamped crew of Steve Levy, Brian Griese, former Bear great Brian Griese.
Of course.
And Louis Riddick, who I've heard a couple of times. They're pretty good. I mean, ESPN, it took them how long to finally figure out, just put a competent team on, the one that doesn't do a lot of shtick, because it's a football game. We just want to watch the football game, and these three guys just let you watch the football game.
So that guy was a booger riding around in the golf cart, that's not a thing anymore?
The booger mobile was grounded during its first season, mostly because the team was not meshing very well. Okay. And part of it could have been that a third of them were zipping up and down the sideline in a sideways driving golf cart. And in most stadiums, the booger mobile was really pissing off the fans who spent a shitload of money because it was pretty tall. And you know, you'd be sitting there and all of a sudden the ball would come down and all of a sudden the booger mobile would be parked in front of you while you were trying to watch the game. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see where that would be annoying.
Yeah. And then Jason Witten went back to play because he hated it so much.
I didn't even know Jason Witten was on the broadcasts.
He did he did 1 year. And then he went back to the Cowboys, and now he's a Raider. He's still playing. No one remembers that because he's not any good.
Yeah. Wow.
He was old when he retired, and he's already squeezed 2 extra years out of his career.
It's a tough way to do it, but more power to you. I would think like being a DH in baseball would be a lot easier if you could do that. But, yeah, sure, why not just put this helmet on?
Well, the crazy thing about Witten was nobody knew he was bald. And then because apparently he's got the Sandberg. You know, I'd like to joke about the fact that, you know, Sandberg only the restore only paid to give him bangs.
Right.
He'd have to pay the rest. He didn't want to. So he just has a little hair in the front. Apparently that's what Witten, he had always kept like a close cropped haircut. And after he retired, I think during the Monday night season, he just looked in the mirror one day and said, "Ah, fuck it." And he shaved his head. And everybody's like, "Wait a minute, what's going on?" He's like, "Well, I don't really have any hair anyway, so I just decided to get rid of it."
Yep.
And they're like, yeah, you're a TV guy. You can't just show up one day with your head shaved." But he did.
Since they're playing on Monday night, I just have to share this other memory that I have. I mentioned the first game I ever went to was a Sunday afternoon in 79. But my first Monday night game, which was exciting and scary and weird, you know, it's like, oh, going into the cold, dark city on a school night. And one of my brother, actually, he was entrusted. My dad, you know, didn't want to bother going down to the city on a Monday night. But I was stoked. It's 1981, I want to say. I don't know the year exactly, but you can look it up. I'm sure it was 1981. I suppose it could have been 82, but they only had a 9-game schedule. Anyway. And I don't know who the third person was, but, you know, I was stoked about it. You know, I don't even remember how we got down there. My brother probably drove, whatever. He was like 7 years older than me. I was just a kid. So I'm 9 years old, and the Bears were bad. You know, I got hooked on a team in 79 that went to the playoffs, and then within short order, they were, you know, back down there. And this would have been Neil Armstrong's last season. And I just remember, I don't even know how the Rams were that year, but the game was really not competitive. It wasn't even close. So all that anticipation going in, and it was probably my first like real understanding of like when a collection of people get sort of just severely intoxicated. You know, I mean, I'd sat in the bleachers. You know, I'd smelled weed in the bleachers, but as far as just like. It's different. You know, it's a day game. People sort of keep, you know, kind of keep their composure. On a Monday night, though, all this hype and people, who knows how long in the parking lot some of these fans were in our section. I just have this image in my head. At one point, the aforementioned Bob Avellini came into the game.
I'm looking at your box score right now. The Bears, he was one of three Bear quarterbacks that day.
And he would have been the third because there was a guy in front of us that I was so amused by. And again, my brother was like 16, but he was kind of, you know, sharp to what was going on in the world. He knew the state of this guy in front of me, and I was kind of figuring it out. And this guy... He was harmless, but I just remember him like spinning his head round and round, putting his hands on his head when Avellini came into the game, and he just kept saying, "I'm so confused, I'm so confused," because by that Avellini, we joked about it. Like he somehow managed to hang on for 10 years. Yeah. Like he was part of this original cropper, you know, this bumper crop of young players, and he was decent for a few years, but then he was like always there all the way through the early part of the '84 season before his fateful interception in Seattle that really etched in your mind or your behavior. I mean, it was a long run. So in 81, it was like, well, these other two guys have been knocked out of the game. Might as well go with Bob. And I just like in my head, I just, cause I remember I burst out, even I got how funny this guy was in his mindset. And I was explained to me later that he was really drunk, but just the spinning his head around, like he had had enough. He had drank enough. He had had enough Avellini. He had had enough Bears. It was 81. They were bad. It sounds like you're looking at the box score, so mm-hmm. you might have a few other beautiful examples to drop in. So.
Bear quarterbacks were sacked 6 times.
Okay.
Bob Avellini twice, Mike Phipps 3 times, and Vince Evans once.
So well, though that triumvirate of quarterbacks actually carried through longer than I thought.
Yeah.
There in 79.
Right, when you have that kind of stable.
When you have three mediocre but otherwise kind of reliable quarterbacks, Hallis, why would you go with it?
Hallis is like, you know, Neil, we already have their names sewn onto their uniforms. Why don't you just keep them?
Sounds about right. Oh my God, they kept those three quarterbacks.
Couple so of fascinating longer. Things. I will give you. $1 million if you can tell me who the Bear kicker was that day. Because I've never heard of this guy ever.
So it was not John Rivetto.
It was not John Rivetto, my favorite Bear kicker of all time.
Right. So I do know, but I'm not going to get this answer, but I do know that there was another kicker that they experimented with after Bob Thomas.
Yes,
but before
he was an experiment.
And he was terrible, and that's why they shit-canned him and eventually settled on Rivetto. Tell me his name.
He is from Denmark. Through via Michigan State. His name was Hans Jorgen Nielsen. He kicked in 3 games for the 81 Bears. He was 1 for 2 field goals, made all of his extra points. Congratulations, Hans Jorgen Nielsen.
Moment of applause. So he wasn't terrible. He missed one kick, huh?
Yeah, that was enough. Who else? He was clearly filling in for someone.
Okay,
who was the kicker?
Could have been Rivetto, maybe.
I think Rivetto
just
was,
one game.
Oh, yep. 3 kickers that year. Bob Thomas.
So that's what
Bob
it was.
2 for 3. The great John Rivetto, 10 for 18. Field goals. That's not good. 19 of 20 extra points.
And a game winner against the Chargers.
And Hans Jorgen Nielsen for 3.
It's wow.
Bob Parsons did all the punting that year. He didn't need any help. But
okay. Okay.
And so in the game you went to, Walter Payton did not have a typical Walter Payton rushing day, probably because of the three idiots who were playing quarterback. 17 carries for 45 yards, but he caught 7 passes for 111 yards.
God bless him.
So Walter was going to get his yards one way or the other.
Right. And yeah, and plus the Bears going through quarterbacks, it just sounds like they're getting drilled. It's like, all right, let's just dump off to Walter.
Other than Walter, it was a very talent-laden offensive unit. The only other guys to carry the ball, Brian Bashnagel caught a pass for 3 yards. Matt Sui ran 10 times for 40 yards and caught 4 passes for 38. Davey Williams caught 3 passes for 15 yards. And my favorite running back of all time, Roland Harper, 1 carry for 8 yards. He's averaging 8 yards a carry, Neil. Feed him.
Unreal. No wonder he lost his job. Neil Armstrong.
Wendell Tyler, yeah. 2 touchdowns rushing for the Rams.
Tyler played in the Super Bowl for the Rams in 79, so he was still there in 81. Okay.
The Rams were quarterback. Oh, a great game from Pat Hayden. 13 of 29 for 210 yards.
Well, in the NFL 1981,
yeah, they didn't carry.
That's borderline right. Exceptional.
Pass completion percentage, nobody gave a shit.
No.
If unless you were 30%. Joe Namath would have to buy a ticket to go to the Hall of Fame if they cared.
Yeah, to say the least. Yeah, how were the Rams that year? Because I was talking about were they even any good? Because they were in that Ritz. You know, they finished 6-10. I guess I'm looking at it
6-10 for the great Ray Malavasi.
But yeah, so they weren't even that good. So it was just a bad football, and it was like the Bears were never like. It seemed like they were rarely on Monday night. It was such a exciting thing. I think partially because that 79 season they were able to be on in 1980, but. You know, Monday Night Football was like, let's watch the game. And at halftime, Howard Cosell is going to do highlights. Yep. And then we might see Walter Payton highlights.
Yep, remember that. You were all excited if the Bears actually made.
Yeah. And it was pretty much, even if they lost, they would show you. We always got to see Payton. You know, we always had that. As bad as the Bears were, we could take pride in sweetness. Just not that night, that my first Monday night game. Exposed to all the debauchery and hopelessness that encompassed Bears fans all too often.
So it's got me thinking, why are the Bears playing the Rams for the third straight season?
Because one of those 3 years they were playing the NFC West regardless, and it just so happened that they finished in the same respective spot in the standings, I guess.
Yeah. Right. So the Bears play all the third place teams.
Yep.
And clearly the NFC South.
And they played them last year because both teams were division winners the year before. But the year before that was when the Bears played the NFC West, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Because then in John Fox's last year, I believe that's when they played the 49ers when Tony Garoppolo made one of his first appearances. So if that's true, that would be the fourth straight year that they've played them.
It's quite a rivalry. So yeah. on the Bear podcast yesterday, Mike Pusateri said that he was going to this game.
Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah. And unfortunately, thanks to COVID, no one is going to this game. But they are going to play in the fancy new stadium out there.
They got a new stadium, huh?
Yeah, it only costs like a couple of billion dollars.
That's it. Is it in Los Angeles or?
It's in Inglewood.
Where the old Forum was.
Forum is still a thing.
Oh, sorry.
Well, but it's like for concerts and stuff.
So the Lakers didn't move into a new Forum. They moved into another place, but the Forum didn't get blown up like the Palace and Chicago Stadium and whatnot. It's still a thing. I did not know that.
I believe that the crazy billionaire who owns the Clippers, Steve Ballmer, I believe he bought the Forum. So I believe he is going to tear it down and build, because they're tired of sharing the Staples Center with the Lakers. I believe that's true.
Okay, and he's going to just build another arena for one of those teams that back at the old site of the Forum, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Ballmer bought the Forum for $400 million, which is pocket change to him. Steve Ballmer.
Right. And like he can milk it because it's like still up to code, right? Until he blows it up.
No, they're gonna stay in the Staples Center until the new stadium is built. the new arena is built.
Okay.
But he is so rich, I believe he has more money than the next 10 NBA owners combined. That's how rich Steve Ballmer is. He still gets big, fat Microsoft checks all the time. So.
Sure.
And he's a little weird, but yeah. Bought the Clippers for $2 billion, paid for it probably right out of his wallet. And I have these two, ever see a billion-dollar bill? I've got two of them. Like, no, that's not, those aren't things. But yeah, so they got a new stadium. They're gonna get Super Bowls again. And
okay, all right.
That was the whole idea when Jerry Jones masterminded not one but two teams in L.A. That was why he wanted them back in the second biggest media market. And apparently now Jerry's jealous because he thinks the new stadium is as nice as the monstrosity that he built.
I wasn't aware of this line of thinking that has Jerry Jones like sort of pulling the strings to get football.
Oh yeah, they're super pissed at him in both San Diego and St. Louis.
St. Louis,
because he kept telling Goodell that it was ridiculous that they didn't have a football team in L.A.
Correct, correct. And, for 20 years,
and Jerry was the one who said financially it really only makes sense if you have two, because then you pretty much have a game in the new stadium every week.
That's right. All right. Good argument. Can't fault the logic.
He was trying to put the Raiders and the Rams together.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah, because you already have established fan bases in both cases that, you know, the team has already played in that city in the past.
I think anecdotally, I think there's probably more Raiders fans in L.A. Actually, not anecdotally, there are. They're probably, with two teams there now, I think there are more Raiders fans than Rams and Chargers fans. Although although they're really not that, I mean, they're in Vegas. They're not that far away now.
Vegas is only 100 miles away from Los Angeles. So that's actually pretty, I mean, it's like Chicago to Rockford. Think about that. They got three NFL teams, maybe not 100. I might be off. But it's not it's a day drive. You could drive from L.A., to Vegas and hit the casinos and come back in a reasonable hour. What is it?
It's a 4-hour drive. 270.
Look it up. It's 4 hours, so it wasn't even close. Still, all right. So, I mean, 100 miles, a little bit off, Midwest boy.
Yeah, everything's 60 miles apart in Illinois.
Right, for us, right.
So it's Chicago to Cedar Rapids,
or Chicago 4 hours you said.
Yep,
just a little bit further than Chicago to Green Bay. Like if you could go, I mean, people will go from Chicago, from the north suburbs especially, to Green Bay and back. That's not even 3 hours.
My Cedar Rapids guess was pretty close.
Is that right?
3 hours and 50 minutes from Chicago to Cedar Rapids.
Check out the brain on Charles Kuralt over here.
Hot damn. Especially for a guy who's never been to Cedar Rapids and is never going to go there. I just guessed at a city in Iowa. Got it right.
That's good. That's good.
All right. Well, I think we've exhausted our Rams knowledge, but it was pretty good. You're right. They were more fun than these quasi-expansion teams.
They are.
It's nice to have one with a little history. And then next week, there's the rich tapestry of Bears Saints, which there really is stuff.
It goes back to sort of Falcons territory. There are things there, but yeah, certainly a lot easier to mine the depths of a team that's been around.
The Bears never got to beat the Falcons to go to the Super Bowl.
That's true, and they've only been able to do that to two teams, and we just finished discussing one of them, so I'll drink to that.
All right, back-to-back weeks where the Bears get teams they vanquished on their way.
Goddamn right. I think that's a sign.
And I still think I want people, somebody out there has to have, somebody put it on YouTube for God's sakes. I want to rewatch and write a, whatever I call those things.
We confused it with Jerry Kramer's biography.
It's not distance replay. It was whatever it is.
You'll figure it out.
Yeah. That's my own column. I wouldn't remember what it's called. I want to rewatch the Saints Bears NFC title game. I think I've only seen it once.
And it's not readily found on the
It is not.
On the interweb.
I don't get it.
Okay.
All right, so I got one last thing here before we go. I have an ethical question for you. Because you're the guy I go to with ethical questions.
Why wouldn't you?
All right, so this happened today. I'm a grown man, but I still play video games. I have a PS4, and it slowly but surely was becoming more and more unreliable. It would, I'd go to turn it on, and it wouldn't boot up. And if I unplugged it and let it sit for 20 minutes and plugged it back in, I could get it to work. And then that started to turn into, it did it like once every couple of months. Then it was doing it once a month. Then it was doing it weekly. Then the other day I went to do it, it was a brick. Wouldn't turn on at all. So I took it to a place here in town. I said, just take a look at it. If it's something serious, I'm not going to spend a lot of money to fix this thing. But if it's something quick and you can fix it, fix it. And they said, okay, that's fine. So they called me that day and said, it's just the power supply. We can swap it out. It's $100 and we'll have it ready for us. That's fine. Let's do it. So I went to pick it up today, walked in, and the ticket that I had that they gave me was for a free diagnostic, which is what they were going to do. They're going to take a look at it, let me know what it was so I could decide where to fix it.
Get customer, get some traffic.
So she's like, are you here to pick one up? I said, yes. I handed her the ticket. She goes back. She brings it out. She sets it down. And she says, I just need you to sign this. And so I grab my wallet. I'm ready to pay. I go to sign it. It says $0. And I said, well, no. I said, I owe money for this. She's like, no, we don't charge for diagnostics. And I said, well, no, he fixed it.
Right, right.
And she's like, that's not what it says. So I took it. And thinking to myself, okay, maybe he didn't actually fix it. So I'll just take it home, plug it in, see if it fires up. If it doesn't, now I know what's wrong with it. And I Googled it. I can fix it myself for half the cost. So I'll just do that. I fired it up. He fixed it. It works.
He did fix it. Okay.
Yes. So I have an ethical dilemma. I have a receipt that says, that I signed, that said I can have my property back for no dollars. But the guy actually did what he said. Now, this is not a mom and pop shop. This is a chain. So it's not like the guy would be out of money.
I was going to ask that because, frankly, it does matter.
Yes.
I think you
should. Should I just keep it? No. Here's what I did. I kept it today for the idea that, all right, I want to make sure this thing. So I played a little bit. I'm going to play it again tomorrow. And if it works tomorrow, my plan is to call them and go, all right, it's fixed. I'd like to pay you for what you fixed. And if tomorrow they're like, then I'm not paying for it.
You've already sort of raised the, you know, kind of gone out of your way to raise the issue that maybe there may have been a misunderstanding. And the lady wasn't having anything of it.
She just wanted to give it to me and get me out of her store.
But you still brought it up. All right. That's a fact.
I tried to pay for it.
Yeah. And so I think it's totally acceptable to do that again because I'm thinking like ultimately at the end of the day at our age, you know, it's like I'm always looking to make a deal, but like I'd be far more inclined to just like whistle around and like 20 years ago than now. So I would probably do the same thing you're doing and like, you know, just for my own, follow it up again. But at some point you can only protest so much that they may have overlooked something where what are we going to do? They're not even missing it to begin with. So, yeah, I would call and give them another chance to acknowledge the services rendered. But, you know, at some point, what are you supposed to do? I mean, you know. I mean.
I'm trying to pay you. But if you don't want to take it, I'm going to stop trying to pay you. That's kind of my theory. You're right. If it was 20 years ago, I would have run out of the store with the thing under my arm, hopped in the car, driven home, and never given another thought.
They're like, oh, my God, I can't believe my luck. I can't believe it. I saved $100.
But now it's like, no, this is somebody's job, and I don't want them.
Right.
If they owned the place, I'd be like, this is how you make money. You need to do this. Now I'm like, what if somebody gets in trouble for, well, what was this? I mean, where there's a part missing, how is it accounted for? And they're like, well, it's in some guy's PlayStation 4. He didn't pay us. But I tried to pay him.
If you bring it up multiple times, and then it almost gives you your own answer because it's kind of telling you, well, it's not going to be missed because they're not that diligent to begin with.
I mean, if I try to pay them tomorrow and they still won't take it,
Yeah, no one's getting chewed out.
I'm done trying to pay for it. But right, I'm no more than happy to pay them because they did what they said, and it worked. And that was what
I think you're on the right path, young Andrew.
All right, good.
To wisdom and morality. I mean, seriously, a second time, just because, again, that point, that's the answer you need is they're not, it's not being missed and no one's getting chewed out. No one's losing their job if they're not going to pick up the ball and you keep sort of pointing it out to them. So thanks for putting me on my heels there with an ethical question, by the way.
Well, Rod Blagojevich was busy, so I thought I'd... That was great. So the last year he was in office,
2008,
every state employee had to start taking mandatory ethics training that had his name on the training because he was basically touting, you know, we're all going to do ethics training. And the reason for it at the time was hilarious. It was that he was getting in trouble for charging his haircuts as Among a business expense.
Wow. Now,
and I think a Rod Blagojevich haircut, that's like a $400 haircut.
Correct. You're not just going down to like, sell, Arenado's place to.
So I always think whenever it comes ethics test time, I always think of Rod.
Yeah. That was a golden fucking test. Yes. I'm guessing.
And it was funny because the very first year we all took the test, there was a haircut question on it, which I just loved. Johnny has a public-facing job, and he needs to
trim his huge pompadour.
Right, he needs to have a. It's required that he have a nice, neat appearance. Can he ask for his haircut expense to be reimbursed? And the answer was no. But,
wow, a little bit on the nose.
I have a feeling somebody wrote it so that when Rod had to take the test. He'd be reminded, like, oh, that's right, I'm not supposed to turn these receipts.
I know one of our listeners is a state of Illinois employee, so I'm going to see if I can maybe walk that one backwards and suss it out.
Well, it was funny, because the year I was, the first year we took it, I was working for a community college, and the board of trustees at our community college was refusing to let us take the test. They were basically saying, no, we're not, you're not state employees. Community colleges are state supported. They're not state funded.
And that seems like a correct argument.
So they're basically saying, we don't want to set the precedent by taking this test. And so this is before that the board at that college went completely nutso. This is when they still had like rational people on the board. And they're like, it's not lost on us that we are telling our own employees not to take an ethics test. But it's not because we don't want them to be ethical. It's because we don't want to set the precedent that we don't want them to be treated to have to fill the requirements of a state employee without any of the benefits of being a state employee. And at some point, the college lawyer finally said, just let him take the damn test. And so
it doesn't matter. Blagojevich won't,
Yeah. So there you have it. Now we've got a little bonus ethics at the end of the podcast.
I like that. It's very very eclectic, this show.
Yes.
I appreciate having been a part of it.
We know John Robinson is alive
and doing shots of Don Julio in the cruiser with a nonagenarian John. I mean, they're the same age, so with John Madden.
I wonder if they just have like the RV parked in John's driveway and he totters out to it and gets in and somebody makes vroom vroom noises at the front and he thinks we're going to Green Bay? Yes, we're going to Green Bay, John. Oh, I didn't pack a jacket. Right. Yes. Boom.
There's a script there. I mean, a 70-year-old story. I mean, it dates back to third grade.
Yep.
Incredible. That's incredible.
All right.
That's a hell of a takeaway. I'm running with that.
All right. Well, thanks, Mike.
Yeah. Thanks, Andy. Till next week, right?
Yep. Go Bears.
Go Bears.
Many of us have herpes.